Good morning. This is an unusual layout. Anybody wants to move their chairs here into the middle of the horseshoe, please feel free to do so. I think I'll make some opening comments sitting down. Might as well join you all. This is going to be a very interesting discussion this morning, just because we are taking a very fresh and might say even a contrarian look at a problem that has seized the world for many, many decades. The situation on the Korean Peninsula, of course, is one of the last remnants of the Cold War confrontations, and it just doesn't seem to come to a point of resolution. I think many of you know here at the Institute, we've been focused on the Korea situation now since 1993, and the four issues that have occupied us during this period, again, don't seem to go away. They modify themselves, but they're still very much with us. I suppose the first thing that grabbed our attention was 1993 and 4, when the DPRK withdrew from the IAEA, precipitating the 1994 nuclear crisis that came to a real confrontational stage. That issue, the nuclear issue, again, continues unresolved. And one of the questions we'll get to perhaps in our discussions is whether the six-party talk framework is going to hopefully lead to a resolution of that question. Then in the mid-90s, the food crisis, of course, grabbed everyone's attention. And I think many of you know the book that Andrew Natsios did while he was a senior fellow here, called The Great North Korean Famine. It was really one of the first efforts to get at some ground truth on what was going on in North Korea by a man who later was the administrator of USAID, the aid administration. And Andrew did a series of in-depth interviews with people. He himself did not get into North Korea, but he talked to numerous people who had been in and out during the mid-90s and later during the period of the food crisis. Is the food issue resolved? We get differing stories, and one of the more interesting changes that has occurred just in the last few months was North Korea, Korean authorities, after having invited in foreign humanitarian assistance organizations to provide food aid, now has said that they had such a good harvest that they've invited the humanitarian assistance organizations to leave. And one of the questions we'll get off into is what was behind that decision? Was it that they, in fact, now have gotten their food problem under control, or did they not want foreign observers looking at their internal situation? Can they count on food assistance from China and from South Korea to make up for their food deficit? Again, an unresolved issue. The third question that we've explored, again, at various points in time over the last decade and more, is the state of U.S.-Republic of Korea relations. This alliance has evolved in recent years as both governments have tried to figure out how to deal with this unresolved set of challenges from North Korea. And those issues remain unresolved. And I'll comment on a minute with some adjustments in the American government's approach to dealing with North Korea. I'll come back to that. And finally, we've looked very darkly at issues related to the state of the North Korean leadership. The food crisis of the 90s has to have had some impact on the policy approaches and maybe even the internal stability of the North Korean leadership. And there have been various rumors, generally not supported with any particular evidence, of internal fights, disaffection within the military, as certain parts of the country were triaged and denied food and local military commanders resisting. There was this reported assassination attempt as Kim Jong-il's train returned from one of his trips to China and to Russia a few years ago. But again, these rumors don't seem to be substantiated or add up to very much. But again, one intuitively assumes that the situation that the North Koreans find themselves in, whether it's the impact of the food deprivation and their economic failings on the population, issues of succession, whatever, a whole range of issues would strain any leadership. And so one of the questions that remains, and we'll get off into this in a minute, is whether there are changes in attitude and policy in the North Korean leadership that give us new policy alternatives. Let me just introduce our speakers briefly and then touch on a couple of the really interesting issues that I hope we'll explore. We're very pleased that Dr. Hazel Smith is with us. She was a senior fellow here at the Institute and produced a book with a great title, Hungry for Peace. That's a hunger that many people in many countries feel, but I think it really very nicely summarizes some of the main themes in her analysis. She is a professor of international relations at the University of Warwick in England, and we're very pleased, again, that she was able to come across the pond, as they say, and be with us for this launch of her book. And she clearly does lay out a very different approach to looking and approaching dealing with North Korea on the assertion that the adjustments that the leadership made to the food crisis, creating certain market conditions, having much more interaction with the outside world, have perhaps diffused some of the paranoia, the fear of outside influences that has always laid behind the Juche philosophy, the reluctance on the part of the hermit kingdom for not just decades, but much longer than that, to deal with the outside world. Catherine Bertini is with us. Again, someone very qualified to comment on these issues. She's now on the faculty of the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. But in terms of our discussion, her direct experience was as United Nations World Food Program official with responsibility for famine relief in North Korea. And finally, we will hear from Dr. Won-Hyuk Lim, currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, but someone who has looked for many years at issues related to possible transformations with the situation between North and South Korea. He's been a fellow at the Korea Development Institute, the Korea National Security Strategy Institute, and in a variety of other roles, has thought about South Korea's policies for dealing with the North. Now, again, I think we're at a point in time when there are a lot of really interesting issues that Hazel Smith's book get us focused on. Did the opening up as a result of the food crisis irrevocably, irreversibly alter the approach, the policies of the North Korean leadership to the outside world? That is something undoubtedly we'll have some lively exchanges on. And again, why were the humanitarian assistance organizations recently asked to leave the North? What is that all about? Leadership change in the North. Has the crisis eased to a point where the leadership can go back to its old ways? One of the things that we're trying to interpret is the meaning of Kim Jong-il's most recent trip to China. He's made a series of trips back in, I think it was 97 or 98. He went to both China and Russia with his military leadership. And I was told by senior South Korean officials that Kim Jong-il wanted to show his military leaders what could be done if they opened up their economy. And the China example was placed before them as showing the benefits a Chinese-style development strategy. And according to the reports received later, the North Korean military said, well, these may be well and good, but the opening up for China was very destabilizing. They had their Tiananmen incident, and we're not interested in opening up that way. Is the more recent trip, again, a signal that there will be a shift in policy towards more openness, something we'll be wanting to talk about? Thirdly, on the six-party talks, again, Hazel Smith's book makes a strong case for adopting a more humanitarian, human security-focused approach to dealing with the North Korea, and in a manner that would ease their fears of outside influence. And one of the things we've seen in this town over the last year and a half or 2 years is a what you might call a loosening up in American policy for dealing with North Korea. The very hardline approach taken during the first 4 years of the Bush administration changed somewhat. Assistant Secretary Chris Hill, who's made several presentations from this podium, has been given much more negotiating leeway, and the question is whether that is making any greater progress in resolving the nuclear issue relative to opportunities for economic assistance. And finally, U.S.-ROK relations. Do we have more of a sense of common strategy now for dealing with the North? We clearly are on the same track with our ally in South Korea in terms of the six-party talks. But on the other hand, we are taking a harder position on things like North Korea's counterfeiting of American currency, their exporting of drugs, and other activities that are viewed as contrary to not only international standards and law, but sustained a sense of confrontation, if not hostility, in the relationship. So we still are grappling with efforts to create a strategy here that will enable us and our long-term ally, the Republic of Korea, to work together. So very interesting issues, and we're delighted that Hazel is now here to walk us through her presentation, then and we'll hear from our commentators. So welcome.
Thank you, Dick. First of all, I would like to say thank you to the USIP, not just for inviting me today, but for taking me on as a senior fellow 3 years ago and giving me a superb place to make a big inroad into writing this book. Without the support from USIP, and the financial support as well as the intellectual space to write this book, and this book, for better or worse, would not have been written, and I'm grateful for that. I'm also grateful for the individuals who assisted me along the way. A particular mention to Joe Clates, who's no longer with us, but was head of the Senior Fellow Program when I was here and is now retired into rural bliss, as far as I can see. But also to all the others in the program, to John Chris, to Elizabeth Drakulich, to Ginny, Cheryl's now taking it over, to Dick, and to all those in publications who steered the book to its final coming out. And believe me, there were a few little hiccups along the way. But thank you to everybody, and I think I ought to say about USIP, given that I'm not just here to talk about the book, but to talk about the book as it comes from USIP, that it's really good to see that there is this, in the European sense of the word, maybe not in the American sense of the word, liberal space where there can be different debates and discussion about important subjects, such as what's happening with North Korea and the rest of the world. So I'm grateful for that, and I think that I'm happy, very happy to have been here. And also I'd like to say, while Mrs. Bettini's here and people from the World Food Programme, that it's my chance to say thank you to the World Food Programme for giving me the opportunity, directly and indirectly, to do some of this work and to appreciate the job that they've done. I want to start by saying that all the very major topics which Dick raised I can't respond to any of them, particularly in relationship to the leadership issues, because I think what we know about North Korea is that the more you know, the less you know on some issues. Anybody who says they're an expert on North Korea simply isn't telling the truth. And I think that the political regime issues in terms of who's going to do what, who's going to be involved in the leadership, who's not going to be involved in the leadership, what policies they might have in the future, is still extremely opaque. Those are things that I couldn't even speculate about. But I do want to talk a little bit about what I think this is a modest effort in this book, what it tries to do, and what the implications of what it tries to do might be for anybody else who wants to take a look at North Korea. Although this is probably not so relevant, I mean, for what it's worth, my background is that I've been working on this subject along with other subjects for nearly 20 years now on North Korea, first visiting in 1990, and then being a few times in the early 1990s as a visiting academic, and then being caught up, as many of us were that are here, in the 1993-94 nuclear crisis as a commentator. And then when the international organisation started to go into North Korea in 95-96, being asked to go and work first with UNICEF and then World Food Programme and then some of the NGOs, so a spiral of involvement. Also, my day job, I'm an international relations academic, my PhD from the LSE, and that's my training in political science and international relations. So that's the angle, and we all come from a different angle, and that's where I come from in terms of my interpretation, my interests, my scholarly interests in thinking about North Korea. So I want to say a little bit, first of all, I know this is a policy audience, but I want to say a little bit about the issue of knowledge of North Korea and scholarship about North Korea. One of the things that I mention in my book is that unlike the situation in 93-94, when many of us were looking at the nuclear crisis. That's one of the reasons why in the post-Cold War era there was a huge interest in what North Korea was doing. Of course, in the United States there had been previous interest from the Pueblo incident in the 1960s. There's more and more interest in the post-Cold War era because North Korea seemed to be stubbornly staying, stubbornly not entering the world of globalization. And more and more of a problem, particularly with the nuclear issue. At that time, North Korea, it was impossible even to know the names of the counties in North Korea. The only names that we had available to us in terms of the naming of the 230-odd counties were the South Korean names, or that were appearing in any works that ever troubled to look at a lower level of analysis within the DPRK. At that time, of course, South Korea and North Korea were still massively far apart from each other, unlike today. There was not the interchange that takes place between North Korea and South Korea on a daily basis, as happens today, even given all the security issues. At that time, there were no foreign international organisations based in the DPRK, and the diplomatic community that was there, the majority of them came also from either closed states or formerly closed states. The ambassadors from Poland, for instance, were the same as had been previously, and their view was that the classic issues of diplomacy, in terms of not interfering in the international affairs of other states, and certainly not interfering in the international affairs of another communist state, should be respected. So there was no natural knowledge interrelationship between the DPRK and the rest of the world. Qualitative knowledge, never mind quantitative knowledge. But post 2005, and post 1995, and certainly today, we are in a vastly different position. And I recommend to you, for those of you who engage in studying the DPRK, if you haven't already done it, to go to the Relief Web website of the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance. Click into DPRK and have a look at the literally thousands of reports, press releases, some substantial reports from the Food and Agriculture Organization, some not very substantial reports at all, some opinion, some knowledge-based, some quantitative, some qualitative. Thousands and thousands of reports, literally, that have been put on the web since the 1995. And have a look at what that might be telling you or why, what it might not. Look at the maps that are available. Look at the data that's available. So we now visibly have a different database, a different knowledge base from that which we had 10 years ago. So we should be able to do some different things than what we could do 10 years ago. I think we're also better able to say these days both what we can know in a scholarly sense and also what we can not know but only have opinion or speculation about. I think we're able to do that now, whereas 10 years ago we didn't really know very much at all, apart with perhaps what was happening in the foreign realm, because we could do some counter-checking with trade statistics from those who have partnerships with the DPRK. And I think this issue of scholarship, which might sound a bit arcane again to a policy audience, is important because it means we can do a lot now from open source documentation. We don't have to rely on intelligence estimates, which can never be sourced by definition, which can never be checked by definition. And we no longer have to rely on anonymous interviewees providing us with our sole source of information. They can be one source of information, but they no longer have to be our sole source of information, which we can do things that scholars like to do. We can replicate, we can present our knowledge in a way that others going to the same sources, either through a process of logic or through checking those sources, can see whether they agree or disagree with you. Because they, as in scientific experiments, if you're doing medical experiments at Stanford University on Alzheimer's, for instance, you set up your experiments so they can be replicated. That's what good science is about, that you can replicate given the sources that are available. So what I tried to show in this book is that we can't do it on everything, but we might be able to do it on more things than we thought we could these days, and we can try to produce knowledge. So I think at least what we can say is that we can these days try to separate out what is opinion, it's perfectly valid to have opinions, but it's not the same as having scholarly analysis, and what is speculation, it's perfectly valid to speculate, but it's not the same as scholarly analysis, from scholarly knowledge. The other thing that I think happened on this issue of knowledge, the knowledge base that we've used to examine the DPRK, North Korea, is that what was a valid knowledge exercise in military terms, assuming worst-based scenarios, for instance, it's certainly very valid if you're a national security planner to assume that the DPRK might have X number of nuclear bombs, given the information that you have, and it's not very good information. Worst-case scenarios as an attribute of military planning have crept into scholarly analysis on this issue of the DPRK as the foundation for knowledge, as if we're certain about some of these things. So I think these days we can separate out that sort of worst-case analysis from the job that of scholarly analysis. And I think the other thing that we can do, given the information that is now available to us, which wasn't before, I'm not saying it's a whole compass, but there at least is more information, is we can try to chart change. The amount of work that looks at DPRK that sees one static picture, when we all know in our human lives, in every society we live in, that it's about change. So, and social science is about charting change. So it's no good coming and saying, because something happened in 1994, that this tells us something about what the DPRK is in 2004. It doesn't do. And so I think that one of the things that we can do, we might not be able to do it very well, is we can start to engage in the difficult job of charting change temporally across time and spatially across different parts of the DPRK. How are things looking differently in different parts of the DPRK? So what I try to argue in this book is that there is an intelligibility to the DPRK. For instance, if we look at its foreign policy, we don't have to be reading the runes to understand the DPRK's foreign policy. We don't even have to understand what Kim Jong-il is saying to his number two for breakfast in the morning. We can say that based on DPRK tells us, and it's, you know, of course it makes some outlandish pronouncements, but also there are some things in what it says that it's just telling you what it wants to say and what it realistically thinks. For instance, it thinks that based on its analysis of United States military and political intentions, this is what it thinks, the United States has three target countries in its foreign policy: Iraq, Iran, and the DPRK. I mean, the axis of evil speech over-egged it a bit, but nevertheless, that there's a coherent foreign policy with these three countries, perhaps including Syria as well, that the United States is very concerned about, because they're not democratic countries, because they're oppressive countries, and because, in many ways, they are a threat to international security. It also considers that it looks at the United States and its rollback of United States troops from the South Korea-North Korea border, and the possible intention to take most of the United States troops out of South Korea, leaving no tripwire, as we've had in Europe, which is why the Europeans wanted to keep the United States troops in Europe, so under in the Cold War, so that if the Soviet Union or anybody else ever attacked, US troops would be directly affected, and therefore that would bring the United States as a government into the European theatre. Has the same view, that if the United States troops, as the Europeans did, the North Koreans, the United States troops go out of South Korea, as they seem to be doing, the plan seems to be, then this leaves the United States open to perhaps engaging in a surgical strike in North Korea, and they feel that this is a realistic scenario planning. It's combined, of course, with the leaked document from the United States that the preemptive nuclear strike was not impossible in certain circumstances. This is their view about North Korea. They've said it about the United States foreign policy to them. They may be accurate or they may not be accurate, but it's their view. And they also feel that one of the things that's not, one of the reasons that they're not being closer to this scenario is because domestically in the United States there's too much discomfort regarding Iraq, that the United States government cannot afford to get into another military adventure, particularly one where its allies, particularly South Korea, doesn't support it at this moment. So I think there's an intelligibility there. And then there's the issue of North Korean society and economy. Again, from the data that we've got, I think that there is no doubt there was a famine in the mid-1990s which killed up to 1 million people. Could be more, could be less. The sober research is saying this. Now, North Korea has a population of about, give or take, 23 million. If we take that figure, that means that, given that figure, 22 million people survived. Now, the question is, how did 22 million people survive when the state could no longer provide anything in the mid-1990s? And the answer is that what took place way prior to the so-called economic reforms of 2002 was spontaneous marketization throughout the country, because people had to get by. This was took place in different degrees in different counties, and it was consolidated not by the central state, because there were many in the central state that fought against this tooth and nail, but by local party officials and local security officials who themselves didn't have any income or any food and were trying to find ways to get by. It's not that they thought that they were ideologically overturning the central state or the Juche ideology or anything else. They were trying to find ways to get by. And it was the party officials, particularly in the small urban areas, who didn't have access to land, that were the most in trouble. This huge party apparatus, this huge security apparatus, who were being paid in a worthless currency, most of them not having access to foreigners, who were having to engage in non-state-directed ways to get by. And in that way, because it was party officials and security officials and, broadly speaking, officials of the state that were doing these things, whether they were teachers or everybody's employed by the state, they were changing the norms of the society. That market is good, not in political sense, of course, in economic sense. And so by the late 1990s, when I believe the state was in disarray and when I believe there were more opportunities for what I call intelligent intervention than there are today, there were different ways in which the government of the North Korea could respond. And it tried on many occasions to roll back these marketization efforts. But in the end, as we all know, in 2002, it decided to find ways to go with the flow and exert control. Now, one of the things about this spontaneous marketization that took place is that in North Korea today, although there's still a mix, you don't just throw out the old social system and on with the new. That doesn't happen in any society. Your position in society, including sometimes your status position, not always, is much more determined by your relationship to the market than it is by your relationship to the state. And what this means is that class relations, in however broadly understood, in North Korea underwent a very major sea change in the last 15 years. The most visible example of this is that the industrial working class that lived in the Northeast, which was the most privileged economically and politically, had disproportionate amounts of representation in the central party apparatus. It was paid more than anybody else. It had access to certain privileges in terms of education, etc., became decimated and impoverished. And it is the industrial working class, people from the industrial working class from the northeast, these huge industrial cities in the northeast of North Korea, Chongjin, Hamhung, Kimchaek, it's these disenfranchised economically and politically workers and the poor, hard-scrabble farmers from that area who also had no access to fertilizer or chemicals or state inputs anymore, who became the core of the refugees and migrants going north into China. They sold their assets, any jewellery they might have, the sewing machines they might have, anything that they could on these markets, and when they went, that this was the area of the country that didn't benefit at all from even the small amount of redevelopment that's taken place in the Sinuiju, Pyongyang, Nampo new economic corridor, and these are the people that were desperate and today remain desperate, although there is some Chinese trade that's going into the area now. So heavy industrial workers, formerly the privileged class within the DPRK, became the most underprivileged, the most likely to be dying of hunger, the most likely to be suffering severe malnutrition among their families, the most likely not to have access to medicines, because medicines only became available from the mid-1990s and late 1990s on the market. You have a doctor, but you don't have access to medicines. The old elite stays in control. You still have the old elites around Kim Jong-un and his family, but you also have a new elite, a nouveau riche, which doesn't have the Swiss bank accounts, but does have access to consumer goods, for instance, second-hand Japanese cars that have come into the country, which they've bought off the process of trade. So you have a new commercial nouveau riche. So I think that North Korean society in the 2000s is not North Korean society as it was before in the 60s, 70s and 80s. It's decentralized and fragmented. Any social welfare allocation takes place at the level of the county and the province. So it's the county and the province that decides which are the vulnerable groups in terms of food allocation, for instance, and if there is surplus in a county and a province, which vulnerable groups should get it at a particular time. And there were always pressures to decentralisation in the DPRK, because the DPRK built its society on the basis that if they were ever at war, the state should be able to decentralise rapidly, not just to the level of the province, but also to the level of the cooperative farms. That's why they made economically irrational decisions that the cooperative farm, one of the reasons, the cooperative farm should be able to fend for itself and also be able to provide food for the rest of the neighbouring urban population should there be a war and the distribution system break down. So the elements that were built into the system for decentralisation, not of being able to decide what policy they wanted to carry out, but in terms of management of day-to-day affairs, were consolidated by these moves towards spontaneous marketisation. And now you have a situation where there is a fragmentation of opportunity as well as of allocation. You've got, of course, within this fragmentation, cross-cutting cleavages of inequality. And as the majority of the society are living in poverty, I think we can say it's cross-cutting cleavages of inequality rather than cross-cutting cleavages of equality. Cross-cutting cleavages of inequality. And these can be based on where you live, not just per province, but within counties within the same province. For instance, if you live in a coal mining county in North Pyongyang, you are likely to be much worse off in terms of food than if you're in a food-producing county in North Pyongyang. That's the province just north of Pyongyang. So geography is one area. If you live in a port area and you've got access to ships coming in, Nampo, Chongjin, Haeju, Songrin, and you can have access to foreigners, Japanese or Chinese, or any of the crews that are coming in, and whether you're a young woman working in a restaurant, or whether you're a highfalutin party official that happens to have contact with foreigners, you're more likely to be able to get some hard currency which can help you on the markets. So geography, gender, the nutrition survey are consistently showing that mothers with children are likely to be more malnourished, and some severely malnourished and some chronically malnourished. As in every other country, mothers are giving food to their children. But so mothers with children are going to be malnourished. Age, if you're elderly and you're not in work, particularly these days when the state's social welfare system doesn't work, you're going to be in trouble in terms of having access to food unless your family can help out. Age in terms of the other end of the spectrum, where there's no weaning food in the system, if you're a toddler and you're poor, you're likely to be severely malnourished. There's no such thing as widespread infant formula available for poor young children who are stopping breastfeeding and then getting on to before they get into solid food. And occupation. And occupation isn't these days linked to whether or not you've got a good party post or not. If you've got a good party post but you've got no access to foreigners or to some mechanism of leveraging your position into fuel or food or income or goods, if you're in some godforsaken county somewhere out of the way of the major ports, you're going to be in trouble even if you are in the party. You can't automatically assume as a party member on its own that you're going to be in a reasonable position. So what I'd say is, Dick's looking at me, which means I have to wind up. All I'd say is that I think that North Korea, there's a lot of research to be done on it, and there's a lot that can be done these days. I've been thinking in comparability terms. In some ways, North Korea reminds me of the Latin American authoritarian states in the 1980s these days, where you had military dictatorships. They allowed businesses to get on with whatever they wanted to do, provided they didn't interfere with the running of the state. So if they did, there was something nasty happened to them. There was no social welfare for the mass of the people, and there was increasing corruption because businesses were paying political leaders in order to be able to have access to the sorts of things that they needed to. The difference is, of course, that in Latin America, even in the dark days of the authoritarian dictatorship, there was a civil society and church-led groups which enabled some hope to be kept alive in terms of the organisation both of the left and the centre against those authoritarian dictatorships. Another comparison, though, that might be more fruitful, and I think we need to see more research on this, is in terms of the comparison between North Korea and non-oil-producing states that were formerly parts of the Soviet Union, or even parts of Russia, for instance, in northeast Russia now today. Here in Russia, you see rising orphans, rising mortality rates, rising extreme poverty. You see that only the most primitive form of capitalism, with only access to the market bringing goods, again, those social welfare systems. You see, in parts of Russia, the maintenance of the old-fashioned bureaucratic system and still, in large parts of Russia, arbitrary rule over the population. And you see also in parts of former Soviet Union still less likely to have a nascent civil or civil society or an activist change. So in this book, the book is attempting to look at what might be intelligible about North Korea. The research question was, what changed in North Korea? Did the humanitarian organisations have anything to do with that? What was the impact of the humanitarian organisations on society at home and foreign policy, if any at all? How did this unprecedented inflow of foreigners bring change or not? And how can we rethink our analytical framework for looking at North Korea in the light of this, so that we can combine these questions of what I've called human security, human rights, humanitarian issues, and the real issues of national security and international security, so that we can have a comprehensive framework for re-looking at what North Korea does and might do, and secondly, what the rest of us who are involved, Britain of course has nothing to do with North Korea, but the rest of us, and the European Union have a little bit, but certainly the United States does, what the other countries that are dealing with North Korea, and of which it's real issues of security dilemma issues that have got to be faced, might do in response to this new knowledge. So sorry for going on.
Not at all. Excellent.
Catherine, would you like to comment or give a perspective, and then we'll go to Professor Lin.
Certainly. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be on the panel today. I accepted to comment about Dr. Smith's book before I read Dr. Smith's book, but based on certainly what I have read that she has written before, I was pleased to accept. And after reading it, I want to also thank her for her recognition of the humanitarian workers who worked in country and recognition of how challenging that responsibility was for so many of them, at least two of whom are here, Masood Haider and Doug Coos, and perhaps others as well. Also for her discussion of so much of the discussion of the positive aspects, despite the some of the problems of the work of all the humanitarian organizations that have done or did do work in North Korea. I want to say hello to so many people who taught me a lot about North Korea that I see around the room today, and we're full of experts, I think, in varying degrees on these issues. In Dr. Smith's book, she talks about various influences that may have changed or did change the way DPRK government operates. And I was struck by her discussion of how humanitarian actors may have influenced the process. I've been giving speeches lately about three examples of effective humanitarian action that have gone beyond the life-saving purpose of humanitarian action. I'm talking about Southern Africa and the drought in 1992, and how the logistical support that had to be provided through to get food into ports in South Africa and through the railways in South Africa to the landlocked countries, even during apartheid, and how that not only helped save lives, but helped to build relations in country between South Africa and other countries that later could be very well used once apartheid fell. About Afghanistan, where the humanitarian workers were absolutely critical to ensuring that food and other supplies got to people in the mountains and throughout the country in the latter part of 2001, saving the borders from being invaded by refugees or for prospective refugees. And then North Korea, where I believe, and Hazel goes into much more in-depth discussion of this, that the humanitarians have really helped to open doors. She goes beyond talking about what it's done within North Korea, but also what it's done with countries outside North Korea, especially as she opened today talking about the wealth of new information that's available to be able to use for analysts of various kinds on issues related to North Korea. I wanted to put into the discussion a few of our own experiences as it relates to some of the points that she made in her book. Starting with 1991, when DPRK wanted to have development aid and invited several agencies into the country asking for development aid. WFP was one who came and left because there was no willingness whatsoever on the part of the government to give any information at all that shows their need for development assistance. So by 94, when the government asked again for some assistance because they said they had a bad weather and didn't ask in a timely fashion, we almost dismissed the request. However, when they did ask in 95, in a timely fashion for assistance based on bad weather that ruined part of their agricultural crops, we did an assessment and checked with other sources and decided, yes, we would have a small program, and that was really the beginning of the humanitarian work there, 95-96. By 97, of course, in what everyone believes was the height of the famine, and when visitors there could see no, even little animals, no birds, no, only a few very skinny oxen, there was a realization that this was far, far greater than some impact on a few agricultural areas. And of course, that's when we expanded the program greatly. Both in 95 and in 96, when we asked the government for various things that we would need to run a humanitarian program, they said yes, yes, yes. Of course, there was a lot of negotiation about what yes meant, but at least the initial reaction was yes, whatever you need, we will provide. That changed over time, so that after there was even more need and more workers and more aid going in, the negotiations, although still progressive, sometimes were more challenging. But still, in about 98, we opened five sub-offices throughout the country, and that was very significant for the humanitarian's ability to be able to operate beyond a short driving distance from Pyongyang. And recalling even the time in 97, when I went to Beijing from North Korea and announced a much larger program, not having any idea how the international community would really react to it, and being concerned that people would say, well, this is a terrible government, we don't want to support it, which was really not a response that we got from anybody but some reporters. But just to be careful, even at that time I quoted Ronald Reagan, a hungry child knows no politics. But we found also a change in the governments, in the regional governments' interests in what was going on as well, and interest in what we could provide them. The first time I went to Tokyo, for instance, in 1992, any meeting I went to was maybe in a room this big with 20 desks, and I sat at some guy's desk and had a conversation with him in the room. And by the time we got in a big way into North Korea business, we were having real discussions with the foreign minister. In 97, when we went to Seoul, none of us could walk through without having seven TV cameras on top of us and reporters banging at the hotel doors and videotapes that we brought out of DPRK and reporters taking videos of the videos to show on the television, because it just wasn't, we had this information that so few others had. This changed very quickly, as Hazel points out in her book, and by 98, 99, there were very regular visits between the two Koreas. And so we saw many, many changes. I'm not sure that there's been much change on the European side other than support for the humanitarians. I remember one ambassador from Europe telling me, well, this is America's problem. We're not getting involved with it. And you recall that in 97, the EU gave, I think it was 100,000 tons of food, at least, to the needs in North Korea. And then the next year gave nothing after a mission saying that there wasn't a humanitarian crisis in North Korea. Nonetheless, once North Korea actually started to go out to countries and asking for diplomatic recognition, some of the European countries were some of the first ones to come forward and say yes. And what we saw from our perspective was initial, with the DPRK officials, initial support and almost partnership, and then more challenging arrangements, but still progress, whether it was creating the sub-offices or or having the nutritional surveys, which were always challenging to work out the procedures for. But eventually, about 2000, we saw 99 and 99 2000, we saw so much less movement in terms of the things we needed to progressively do a better job in doing monitoring. And coincidentally, that was exactly the same time as the government of DPRK started to be proactive to try to get bilateral relations with other countries. And Hazel points out in her book that over a 10-year period, 42 countries have recognized DPRK, and Germany and UK added embassies there in addition to Sweden and Poland and Italy and the EU added aid missions in addition to the Swiss aid mission, and then Australia and New Zealand, who had been always there from the very beginning, always supportive of DPRK, they recognized them as well as Canada and others. What happened in terms of how the decisions were made on high in the country in order to do that, I didn't know, but what I suspected was that it was possible that these pesky humanitarians wandering around the country could be decreased if only we had more bilateral aid coming in from other countries, and as we did from China, as we DPRK did from China. And when we learned that ROK was considering giving large amounts of food bilaterally, I met with President Kim Dae-jung and said, please, if you give food, please also give through the multilateral system, especially because it's so important for the other major donors to use the multilateral system so that it can be properly monitored. And he did. He split his country's contribution, some bilateral and some multilateral. But now, with the ROK contribution being almost exclusively bilateral, there's certainly a lot more in DPRK's cupboard that doesn't need the monitoring and doesn't need the extra assessments that the humanitarians give. And the DPRK has now come back and said, thank you very much, but we really don't need you anymore. This is arguable, of course. I believe that the statistics show still a shortfall of 150 to 200,000 tons, if I'm not mistaken, even now, this coming year. But for various reasons, this, I believe, being one, the country said no. What are the options? There were about less than a dozen NGOs left, mostly Europeans. Several have announced they're not going to stay. Several others are still contemplating what they're going to do. Other issues come into fore with them as well. WFP could have said, we succeeded, declared victory, and left. They're looking like that's not what they're doing. They're putting together what they call a protracted relief and recovery operation, which is kind of a step between an emergency operation and a development operation. Development would never fly in the context of the donors to WFP. As I understand it, for some time, Japan, among others, really, and the U.S. as well, didn't want this to be considered development, but UNDP recently had all the governments agree with a proposal for a $10 million two-year development-type project in North Korea. And so WFP is considering presenting to its board a proposal for about a $100 million project for 1.9 million beneficiaries, with a total of about 150,000 tons in this category of protracted relief and recovery, which means the North Korean concern not to have it be considered an emergency, and at the same time meets the donor concerns not to have it be a development. This was tried in the past, but the donors didn't want to do it, but now it may be something that would be accepted. WFP still need DPRK's approval for all the various things that the government needs to ensure to provide for WFP even to continue on that basis. But that is the current discussion and the current current proposed plan. How that carries out in the future, we can only guess.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Dr. Lim, and then hopefully we'll have about 45 minutes for a Q&A.
Let me just try to work this out, yeah. Okay. Thank you for inviting me to this seminar. I'd like to talk first about Professor Snisbet and then talk about economic prospects in North Korea, and finally touch on issues like human rights and security issues. These are three images that North Korea usually show whenever I give a talk. As you can see, the malnourished children on the upper left corner, and bottom left is a photo of a garment factory in Pyongyang, and this was reported in July 2002 by The Economist. Was viewed as a sign of change in North Korea. But obviously, the dominant image that people associate with North Korea is the menace that Kim Jong-il presents and the nuclear program that North Korea has. And it's kind of difficult to interpret what North Korea is or where it's at given these contrasting images. And what Professor Smith did in her book is to argue first that there seems to be a problem with a lot of literature on North Korea, because by combining poor theory with DPRK opacity, you create sort of a worst case scenarios. Right? And then that leads to bad policy, which she terms securitization. Now, I'm an economist, and securitization in economics has a very different meaning than what she wants to say, but basically it's security dominated a perspective when formulating a policy toward North Korea. Another problem is demonization. Okay. And just for just to summarize her argument, I just drew a 2x2 matrix here. She says that there are two problematic conventional approaches to North Korea, theoretical approaches to North Korea. She calls that bad and mad approach. In the bad approach, the North Korean state is viewed as a rational but malicious actor. And there's a hard variant and soft variant. And in the hard version, the North Korean state is viewed as irredeemable. So regime change is probably the only alternative that's desirable in this regard. A soft variant has the North Korean state being untrustworthy. So, and both variants are concerned with the possibility of strategic deception on the part of North Korea. So in the bad approach, the North Korean state is rational, but it's basically malicious, and we can't trust him. In the mad approach to North Korea, the North Korean state is viewed as an irrational and unknowable actor. And in the hard variant, it's supposed to be barbaric. Professor Smith talks about reports about cannibalism happening in North Korea, although the rumors are unsubstantiated. In the soft variant of this mad approach, North Korean state is unpredictable, viewed as unpredictable. And the common theme that underlies these two variants is this idea of crazy behavior on the part of North Korea, and we can't really figure out what it's about to do. Now, her alternative conceptualization is rather long, but it's historicized and contextualized rational actor. So it's a rational actor and has some historical baggage, things like fight against the Japanese and for independence, and the Cold War over more than half a century and so on. And she also views the North Korean state as a non-monolithic entity. So she proposes a very different approach and, in fact, uses that approach in her book. So I'd like to recommend that every one of you read it. It's very a good perspective. The only sort of quibble I had with her book is, I'm an economist, and it's the absence of tables and figures. It would have been much more visually attractive to have tables and figures, but that's about it. I argued that poor theory and DPRK opacity contribute to bad policy in the end. And one of the issues that Professor Smith raises in her book is information accessibility of North Korea. In fact, what she argues is that North Korea is quite knowable, especially since 1995. And in fact, I can sort of support her argument in that if you put in enough time, there's information out there you can use to figure out what the North Korean state of North Korea is. In fact, I'm handing out a couple of articles I wrote, and one of them is North Korea's Food Crisis, which I wrote back in 1997, and it's kind of amazing looking back. But at the end of 96 and even in early 1997, there was a debate as to how serious the North Korean famine was. In fact, what researchers would typically do was to estimate food production in North Korea using test plots near the DMZ and also taking into account grain output in northeastern provinces of China and so on. And then they would figure out sort of appropriate level of food demand in North Korea. And they would note that there's a shortfall or gap of about 2 million tons. But then they turn around and say, North Korea still has a huge military rice stock. So if Pyongyang releases this military rice stock, and also people in North Korea hunker down a little, so instead of going for appropriate food demand, sort of realistic food demand, then this problem can be dealt with. And all these reports of hunger and so on are sort of isolated instances in North Korea. That was sort of the predominant view at the time. What I did in 1997 is to look at that argument, and I made two points basically in the paper. That is, North Korea's military rice stock is not large. North Korea has a military of about 1.2 million soldiers, but North Korean population is 24 million, right? So it's 1/20. Okay. So even if the military has, say, 6 months of rice stock, sort of a typical amount, for the whole population, it's only 6/20. Okay. So that's only about 9 days' worth of food for the whole population. Also, there was intelligence information from defectors at the time, which was publicly available, that Pyongyang began to distribute newly harvested rice in 1995, right after the harvest. Now, if you had a huge rice stock, military or civilian, you would presumably, hand out old rice first and then dip into newly harvested rice. The fact that they were distributing newly harvested rice told me that the rice stock that Pyongyang had at the time wasn't that big. As for the second point, the size of realistic food demand, what I did was to look at sort of historical data in Korea. And supposedly, the food situation in Korea was at its worst during the about the 1942-1945 period, when Korea was under Japanese colonial occupation and Japan was fighting the Great Pacific War. Okay, there was a Russian and stories said that people were living on grass roots and tree bark. Sort of. And I looked at historical data and figured out the food demand at the time. And the reason I looked at that was because if North Korea could somehow maintain and hand out that level of food as the Japanese regime did in 1942 through 1945, maybe there wouldn't be famine. Right? That is, you have sort of a semi-war or war footing in the country, have a pretty good population control, and have the level of food provision that matches Japanese colonial regimes in 1942 through 1945, then there wouldn't be a problem. But when I looked at the estimates, it was pretty clear that Pyongyang couldn't even provide that much. So given this, these two bits of arguments, I concluded that there was a serious food problem in Korea and in North Korea at the time, and in fact that turned out to be the case. And in many cases, I mean, it's rather frustrating to look at North Korea as an economist or as an intelligence officer or whatever, because there's no national income account and so on, and information is not as readily available as in OECD countries, for instance. But there's enough out there. If you put in enough time, you should be able to form a reasonably good picture of what's going on in North Korea. And I agree with Professor Smith on that point. Now, as to the recent debate on humanitarian aid and transparency, I think there are basically three questions. How much access did humanitarian organizations have in North Korea, and how did it change over time? And according to Professor Smith's book, they did have pretty good access, perhaps not at the individual household level, but at the individual county level and also major institutional level, like nurseries and so on. Humanitarian organizations had a fairly good information access in North Korea. And it tended to improve over time, at least until recently. That would be the answer to the first question. Now, what accounts for changes in accessibility? I think there are two things to look at. One is North Korea's need for food assistance and concern for political stability. Okay. Now, if you can provide enough food on your own, then you probably don't need to allow all this access by international organizations, given North Korea's concern about regime security. The other factor is confidence building and this idea of sort of poison carrot and Trojan horse that Pyongyang has. Regarding confidence building, it's pretty clear from Professor Smith's book, accessibility improved over time, at least until recently, thanks to increased mutual trust between international organizations in North Korea and Pyongyang authorities. Now, then what changed recently? I think the improved harvest is a major factor, okay? But the other factor is this idea of Trojan horse, poison carrot, became sort of an issue in Pyongyang because of increased attention focused on North Korean human rights. 2004-2005, and they, I think, came to see international organizations' presence as more threatening than before. And now the negotiation is going on between international organizations and Pyongyang regarding this, and it remains to be seen how it's going to be resolved in the future. A more fundamental question I'd like to raise is this: the choice between saving people and enhancing transparency. Now, given international organizations' need to persuade donors, they would like to have as much transparency as possible and save people. But if given a choice between saving people and enhancing transparency, what should you choose? That's kind of a tough fundamental question that we are faced with. And related to that is food diversion a real issue, or is it a red herring? This is sort of a schematic of North Korea's food distribution scheme and the social pyramid. Kim Jong-il is at the apex of the social pyramid. There's elite, and there are military and party people. And at the bottom of the social pyramid in North Korea, there are the underprivileged or unprivileged. Okay. Now, we can obviously sort of think of it this way. Total availability of food in North Korea is equal to production plus inventory drawdown, the drawdown from the rice stock and so on, imports and aid. Okay. And what appeared to have happened over the past decade or so is, is that as late as 1992, North Korea was able to, or I would say 1994, in fact, I would say North Korea was able to take care of its food problem on its own. Production plus inventory drawdown plus imports took care of the food problem. Now, with the great decline in fertilizer consumption and great reduction in imports, commercial imports and so on, food production began to decline, and by 1995-96, North Korea had a serious problem, and by 1998, the amount of food it was able to obtain through production, inventory drawdown, imports, and aid couldn't cover the whole population. Okay. Now, if you go back to 1992 and think about it, even when it was able to feed the whole population, when it was able to feed the whole population, had enough food to feed the whole population, Pyongyang wasn't like diverting food from unprivileged people in North Korea for the military and elite so that they can eat more. Okay. So, I mean, Pyongyang is concerned about social stability, and if there's enough food to trickle down to unprivileged, then they will be able to have food. That's the basic situation I see. And since 1998, total availability in North Korea has increased thanks to increased production, imports, and aid. Okay, and with the increase in production, it can cover, North Korea can cover more and more of the population. So where is diversion a real problem? Okay, that's the sense in which I asked this question. But in a way, I completely agree that transparency is an important value on its own, because as Professor Smith documents in her book, by interacting with North Korean authorities and building confidence, we can promote further change in North Korea. So it's a very good thing to ask for transparency when providing food to North Korea. Okay. But when it comes to the bottom line, I think diversion is really a red herring of an issue. Okay. Now, we talked about policy implications of sort of worst case analysis, and demonization is a problem. I'll just give you a simple example, somewhat provocative example, okay? It's one thing to say Kim Jong-il is preoccupied with military security, he ruthlessly suppresses dissent, he missed out on strategic deals with the United States when the Clinton administration was in office, he's rather hesitant in implementing economic reform, but it's quite another to say Kim Jong-il starves his own people as if, he's doing that for fun. Okay. An analogy I would draw is the response to Hurricane Katrina. It's one thing to say President George W. Bush is preoccupied with tax cuts, is fighting the wrong war in Iraq, is appointing people like Mike Brown at FEMA, and on the whole, he's not paying as much attention as he needs to the problem of home security after 9/11, because after all, after 9/11,
major levies in major levies like the one in New Orleans were viewed as a possible terrorist targets. And I was quite amazed that there was no real plan to secure the levee and also to have an effective evacuation problem, evacuation program for people in New Orleans, especially those without cars. But it's one thing to criticize George W. Bush for misplaced priorities and incompetence, and quite another to say he floods his own people. That's the
sense in which I put the demonization debate.
Now let me move on to North Korea's economic situation. If you, what I have here is a graph that shows trends in North Korea's gross national income, total trade, oil imports, and fertilizer consumption. And the most reliable indicators among these, I would argue, is total trade, because mirror statistics are available. And what you see is that since 1999-2000, trade has improved a great deal. And I think there are, and the primary reason for that is in May 2000, Kim Jong-il visits China, visits Beijing, and basically normalized relations with China in a way, because for a long time, Pyongyang was calling Beijing sort of a traitor to the socialist cause, and he Pyongyang was dissatisfied with the fact that Beijing normalized relations with Seoul in 1992. But in May 2000, Kim Jong-il visited Beijing and normalized relations. And June 2000, there was an inter-Korean summit. And if you graph economic trends in North Korea, you see a rapid recovery, in fact, since 2000, I would argue. Yeah. And if you and what I'd like to do is put North Korea's economic reform in context. Details are provided in the other paper I'm distributing. The title of the paper is North Korea's Economic Futures. And I would just like to note one thing, that because of the famine, the size of the informal sector increased a great deal. Relative size of the informal sector in North Korea increased a great deal. And a big challenge for Pyongyang is to strike a balance between the formal sector and the informal sector. And that question, that challenge is still a relevant one. And there's a sense that Pyongyang is trying to transform and rehabilitate the formal sector so as to have more control over economic development money in North Korea. But it's not clear how it's going to approach this question of striking a balance between the formal sector and the informal sector. And finally, the question of human rights, peace, and politics. In the United States, there are people who criticize Seoul's position on human rights in North Korea. Okay. But whenever I hear that, what I try and tell them is to have a thought experiment. Okay. Now, Richard Nixon visited China back in 1972 when China was not really a bastion of liberty. Okay, and I asked my American colleagues, what would Washington have done if a third country tried to pass a resolution on human rights abuses in Maoist China and condemn Maoist China publicly? Time. I think the official Washington response would have been to pursue quiet diplomacy rather than this sort of naming and shaming approach. And there would be two reasons to pursue quiet diplomacy. A person like, you know, Henry Kissinger could say he could care less about human rights in China, and it's more important to maintain stability in international relations and use the China card against the Soviet Union. Okay, that's the idea of putting peace or stability before human rights. Now, the other response or the other justification for using quiet diplomacy would be to say it would be more effective to engage with Maoist China and work quietly if we are really serious about improving human rights in China. Indeed, I think that was pretty much the case. And there, the idea is to promote human rights and peace at the same time. This idea of using the policy combination of peaceful coexistence and change through rapprochement. And in many ways, the South Korean government has sort of mishandled this issue, because even the human rights ambassador of South Korea made a statement putting peace before human rights. I mean, he's not really a heartless realist, but and he's a human rights, supposed to be a human rights ambassador, but he made that statement. But I think what the South Korean government has to do is to make clear that it is seeking a policy combination of peaceful coexistence and change through rapprochement. And it's kind of emphasized this combination, because peaceful coexistence alone is not going to improve human rights. That could just, you know, degenerate into the implicit endorsement of human rights abuses in North Korea. It has to be also changed through increased interaction or changed through rapprochement. And finally, I'd like to add there's sort of a domestic political dimension to human rights issue in South Korea, because so far, other than some North Korean defectors in South Korea, the most vocal critics of North Korean human rights abuses in South Korea have been right-wing politicians and right-wing newspapers that tended to collaborate with military regimes in South Korea. And they seriously have a credibility problem. It's not like, you know, representative, someone like Jim Leach in the United States criticizing human rights in North human rights practices in North Korea. And in fact, in many ways, for them to speak out in lofty terms against human rights abuses, it's like chicken hawks in the United States preaching about national security. And luckily, so far, South Korean newspapers haven't figured out a way to sweep both former democracy activists in South Korea. And understandably, former democracy activists are not willing to side with right-wing politicians and newspapers to criticize North Korean human rights abuses and advocate regime change. And in fact, those who are beginning to speak out in the pro-democracy camp are separating the issue of human rights and regime change. And in many ways, I mean, human rights is always a difficult issue, and I think a proper strategy for South Korea to take is to have different roles for the government and NGOs. That is, the government as sort of the major promoter of engagement with North Korea should pursue quiet diplomacy, but NGOs could be more vocal about the abuses in North Korea. Thank you.
Thank you all. We've covered quite a lot of terrain. I think Professor Smith has really shed some light on and given us a sense of the variations that it's very hard for outsiders to see. We've heard from Dr. Lim some of the policy implications. The floor is now open. Hopefully we'll have a half hour, a little more, to explore some of these issues. Please.
Just one comment.
Please identify yourself. Sure. And direct your question to
Kim Byung-gi from Korea University, affiliated with Georgetown. Just one comment and one question. I really learned quite a lot from very excellent presentation. About systematically theorizing or understanding North Korea, I think you probably know this. There's been first-rate works done in the 70s, like Scalapino and Lee, Communism in Korea. Even on the economic side, Dr. Joseph Chung, North Korean Economic Structure and Process, 1977. And then a whole slew of transitology work, Bureaucratic Authoritarian Regimes, 86, 95, you know, Larry Diamond and Lawrence White and others. So I think there's a wealth of very good work in a comparative and theoretical and historical works that are able to really place North Korea in a very sober manner, and I would hope to see more of that. The second question is more practical. I was wondering if you could kindly respond to the public distribution system, of which transparency is an important actor. And I tend to, when you meet Western NGOs, the need to check. But on the one hand, they're trying to prop up the PDS system. But when North Korea does that, it reinforces the kind of centralizing structure which goes against the devolution and the kind of evolution towards a market economy, more towards kind of the ideals that, you know, our president and of course Western liberals or progressive scholars. So I'm wondering, PDS penultimately reinforces the dictator very, very centralizing tendencies, and I was wondering, in a policy sense, particularly Dr. Im Hyun-yok, very distinguished, if I could get a comment. I just have to say one thing. I think it would be very unfair to say that criticism of human rights on North Korea is done in a very unified actor. There are different media, different political actors, and I think it's much more diffuse than maybe you might care to characterize. Because in the 70s, if you look at three dailies, one was quite conservative, one was interested in economic business development, other one was extremely human rights, which tends to be extremely conservative today. So I thought maybe your description is a bit overriding. That's my comment and question. Yeah,
two things. First, I'm aware of the work that you mentioned, although I'm not so sure that, for instance, in the latter case, Diamond and Schmitter's work, that framework can be applied to North Korea, mainly because they were concerned with elections or non-elections and the sort of political structure. What I've been trying to do is to look at the socio-economy, but of course there has been other work as well. What I focus also is trying to think about how understanding the socio-economy can be used as part of an analytical framework to help understand international security dilemmas. Because it's my discipline, and so I'm, like everybody, you know, constrained by my parameters. In our discipline, still the most common approach is to use the state as the black box actor. Nothing inside the state, you only look at what it does in foreign policy terms. There have been domestic politics explanations of international politics, and I refer to some of them in my introduction, looking at the state as somebody called Graham Allison has done some work on the Cuban Missile Crisis, argues that you need to look at what bureaucracies do within the state to understand different possible outcomes in foreign policy. And one of the things I say is that we need to actually go further than that and look at the relationships of power, social power, inside the state, in order to understand both the pressures on the government, and that can help us understand the sorts of parameters within which they're working. That's the first side, and that is actually not done very often in my discipline. And secondly, this whole debate, which we haven't got time to talk about, between human security approaches to thinking about international security and national security approaches to think about international security, not on the issue of North Korea, but conceptually in general, they tend to be disaggregated in my discipline. And so that there are those that are concerned with weapons of mass destruction, and there are those concerned with human rights and whether or not people are being fed. What I've argued is that they're equally important in terms of thinking about a conceptual framework for understanding what populations' interests are in terms of domestic and foreign policy, but also what governments' interests are and what their interlocutors' interests are, i.e. those people who have to make foreign policy towards those states. So that's what I tried to do, and successfully or not. So that established the overall framework for the book, and in my discipline, that hasn't been done before. And it's not a theoretical book in the sense, although it does have a framework that helps me understand the material. First thing, on the public distribution system in the DPRK, you know, I think the semantics get in the way of understanding what's happened. The public distribution system wasn't simply the hundreds of warehouses which held food and other goods throughout the society, throughout the country, in the different counties, which then doled out the goods depending on what entitlement people had. The public distribution system, the software, was based on a society where workplaces basically determined what you got. You had an income system of workplaces. Nowadays, and for a long time actually, because a lot of the old workplaces that were privileged disintegrated, like factories, that doesn't exist anymore. So the public distribution system, in terms of the overall conceptual structure, what it was meant to be and where it came from, simply doesn't exist. It doesn't mean to say there isn't a physical public distribution system, and those warehouses don't have food in them sometimes, although some have been shut down and converted to schools, for instance, because the market provides a lot of what people want. But it does mean to say that it's been reconstituted. And one of the ways it's been reconstituted is that for most counties, if you get food, not usually goods anymore, but basic food, from the county or even at the RE level or the district level, it's a ration of last resort. And it's the counties that decide who, given the limited amount of food they have in an area at a particular time, depending whether it's a harvest or not, gets what food. It could be the miners if they think that it's a priority in that county to be producing coal over that particular period of time. It could be pregnant women, if the government's got a campaign, as it has been doing, to try to get women to have more children. It could be at the elderly, although they usually come right down the bottom because nowadays everybody's supposed to fend for themselves and therefore the families are supposed to provide for them. So you've still got a warehouse system, although it's very truncated now, and it still has food in it sometimes, but it's distributed according to different principles which reflect the change in the society that's taken place over the last 10 or 15 years. Of course, there's been some attempt that, you know, the government's in the last couple of 6 months or so has tried to say we're going to impose the old system. They know they can't. I mean, this is part and parcel of trying to reassert political control rather than economic control over society. They know they can't. But of course, it provides a stick to beat people who are being a bit too far off in terms of pursuit of this new golden age of capitalism that's appearing in North Korea.
PDS, public distribution system, is an interesting question, and that goes to the point I made about about striking a balance between the formal and informal sector. In the late 1990s, early 2000s, I think about 60% of food ordinary North Koreans got derived from farmers' markets, informal markets. Now, if you look at the measures Pyongyang took in July 2002, what it basically did was to try to reduce distortions in prices. There were two distortions. One was that there was a huge subsidy. For instance, rice was sold at 0.081 per kilogram, but procured at 0.801. So there was a huge implicit subsidy in there. But there was also a huge intersectoral price gap between the formal sector and the informal sector, because in farmers' markets in 2002, rice was being sold at about 51 per kilogram. So in order to eliminate or at least reduce these arbitrage opportunities and prevent the further hollowing out of the state, Pyongyang basically did in 2002 was to import this market mechanism into the formal sector, raise both procurement and sales prices for rice, for example. And what it did immediately afterwards was to crack down on farmers' markets. Their argument basically was to, you know, the public sector has been transformed and rehabilitated, so why don't you guys all come to the public sector and trade instead of hanging out in the informal sector? But what happened was that created a lot of disruptions, and there was fear of sort of a policy-induced food crisis, because that would produce disruptions in the distribution chain. And in March 2003, Pyongyang sort of gave up on that idea and decided to just allow and even expand farmers' markets into general markets and impose taxes instead, levies and taxes. Now, the recent move in the fall of 2005 reminds me of that attempt in 2002, in the summer of 2002. And I think the fundamental problem is this. As long as there are profitable sales opportunities, okay, in the informal sector, absenteeism, AWOL, is likely to be a significant problem in the formal sector. Workers just, you know, go to farmers' markets and sell what they could and make profits and buy what they could. Right? But at the same time, Pyongyang authorities are apparently not confident enough to allow sort of the proliferation of business enterprises, which require
stronger property rights and also large amount of capital. So although the share of the informal sector in distribution services is quite large, right, its share in manufacturing and other services that require large capital is rather small. And this sort of this capital labor mismatch problem between the formal sector and the informal sector. And in my reading, what they basically did in the fall of last year was to try and bring back workers into the formal sector by offering rice at 2002 prices instead of, you know, 2005 prices. So there's an incentive for workers to report back to work and, you know, and spend their time in factories. But I don't know whether this approach is going to work. But at the same time, I think it would be rather unrealistic to expect Pyongyang to suddenly liberalize the establishment of business and of private business enterprises at their stage of development. I mean, even in China, it took more than a decade to get to that stage. So it remains to be seen whether this new attempt to crack down on the informal sector is going to be successful in the first place, and how Pyongyang would try and kind of exert more control over economic modernization and development.
Thank you. Want to comment on any of these issues? Okay, I have a list with four folks. The gentleman here, Mark Nolan, lady there, and then this gentleman, please.
Me?
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Alexander Vorontsov. I'm the Brookings Institution Visiting Fellow. And first of all, I would like to express deep gratitude to USP Institute for the organizing this extremely interesting seminar. And I enjoyed the whole presentation. And I would like to stress that I was enjoyed again to meet the British intellectual thought representative in regards with North Korea analysis. And I remind my experience in North Korea when I was a diplomat in our embassy, in Russian embassy in North Korea, 4 or 5 years ago, and we had the opportunity to meet the first British diplomats in Pyongyang who were prepared the British embassy opening. They were headed by Dr. Ho. And we were surprised and pleased very much simultaneously to meet a little bit unexpected for us analysis from so-called Western camp approaches to North Korea. And we were pleased to hear from Dr. Ho understanding that the mentor approach to North Korea, the attempt to teach them, to attempt to make direct recommendation what is good, what is not good, is counterproductive. And what just now Ms. Smith emphasizes that the long-term oriented hard job and of course sophisticated job on the gradual basis to engage North Korea in the market-oriented changes has a good chance. And just now what was stressed that the simultaneous marketization achieved a very substantial scale and level in North Korea. It became the life, it became the real fact. It's emphasized that this approach aimed at the gradual and temporarily work with North Korea, it's a productive approach. And now we have some evidence and result that this long-oriented job aimed at the gradual changes in North Korea, social changes in North Korea society, is a real policy which can lead to the real results. Thank you.
Okay, Mark. I just want to try to pull together in a slightly different way a number of points that people have made and add a couple. First of all, I want to underline something that Hazel said at the outset, which I think is really important.
If you stand there at the mic, you'll
your words will be recorded for lots of folks.
Okay, I want to underline something Hazel said at the outset, which I think is a really important analytical point, and I think it's generally missed here in Washington. And that is that if you talk about marketization of the North Korean economy, you have to understand that this was not a planned top-down policy. This was not a decision that policymakers in Pyongyang made because they desired to see particular economic or political outcomes. It is a process that came out of the trauma of the famine and came from the bottom up. And as Hazel said, the response of the government, including the July 2002 reforms, has been an ambivalent one and has in some ways been to ratify the changes that occurred from the bottom up and had been going on for a period of years, but importantly was also an attempt to control that process. The primary institutional mechanism through which North Korean households access food, say in 2004 or 2005, is the market. It's not the PDS system. So when the government bans, in the fall of 2005, private trade in grain, this is a big deal because this is banning the primary mechanism through which households actually obtain food. Secondly, what has not been mentioned, which I think is actually as important or more important than the expulsion of the WFP, well, they're not going to be expelled, they'll cobble together some kind of deal, is the reneging of the North Korean government on contracts with the farmers about how food produced on the cooperative farms and private plots are distributed. Food produced on the cooperative farms, there's a kind of sharecropping formula that determines what is sold to the state at the state procurement price and what is available for free disposal. Basically, in the fall of 2005, the government went in and reneged on that, simply seized the grain. Presumably, this will have supply-side implications further down the line. And so, last point is that I think that kind of putting some of this together, I think that Phil was a little generous to the North Korean government in his rendition of history in the 1990s. The North Korean government, as a policy matter, cut commercial imports of food, cut them to almost zero. Right? Today, in that little schema that Phil laid out, the main source of food consumed in North Korea is domestic consumption, or domestic production. Second component is aid. The third component, commercial imports, basically doesn't exist because the government simply doesn't import food. In that context, that is the context in which you have to then evaluate the South Korean aid program, which has been alluded to, which has essentially undercut the WFP's ability to negotiate transparency and monitoring. And while transformation may be one value associated with transparency, under this system, the primary reason one wants a transparent program is to have some assurance that your aid is actually reaching the intended beneficiaries, not politically determined beneficiaries. And so when you add these things together, the banning of private trade in grain, which is the principal mechanism through which people actually obtain food, the strengthening of the politically determined PDS system through the South Korean aid program, and now possible adverse developments on the supply side associated with the government reneging on its contracts with farmers, I think that that puts a different spin on Phil's comments about human rights and the extent to which South Korean government policy may support any kind of human rights development in North Korea. Thank you.
Any comments here on these?
As I mentioned in my previous statement, it remains to be seen what's going to happen to the latest episode of crackdown. Did you could see a repeat of 2002-2003, or this could be more sustainable? I don't know. So that's one comment. And regarding ROK or South Korea undercutting WFP's negotiating leverage, since 2001, as Ms. Bertini mentioned, South Korea has been providing 100,000 tons of corn through WFP, multilateral channels. That amount has not been changed, okay, but the share of South Korea's contribution to multilateral humanitarian efforts has increased. The reason is that everybody else is reducing their food. Okay. So it's not that South Korea by itself is undercutting WFP's negotiating leverage. It's more the case that from Pyongyang's point of view, the relevance of WFP has decreased. That would be the argument I would make. And with regard to the reduction in commercial imports, right? And in fact, I mean, South Korea is providing more food, accepting more defectors from North Korea and so on. So I don't know how the human rights attack, human rights issue should be pointed at South Korea more than other countries in the first place. And with regard to commercial imports being cut, I think basically Pyongyang's calculation is that with increased production and aid, both from China and South Korea, as well as residual multilateral aid, they could get by. Okay, so they would use the money they used to spend on commercial inputs and food on other uses. Now then, if I say that, then what people usually say is, you know, they are just going to use that for military spending and so on. But there are a lot of other uses for hard currency as well. They are importing construction equipment and so on. So it's not clear to me what kind of argument you are making by saying the reduction in commercial imports implies some kind of a willful behavior on the part of Pyongyang.
Well, I guess it's not just the references to President Bush that I disagree with you about. I do think, as I said, that we could see coming when there are better relationships growing between DPRK and other countries, which is good, but we could see coming that there would be more bilateral aid coming in, which means coming in without strings, at least in terms of how it's managed and how it's processed and how it's transparent, and that over the long term had the capacity to undercut the operations of WFP and the NGOs who actually were following where the food is going to try to ensure, as we do everywhere in the world, that the food is getting to the place where it's supposed to be. So I think it's a real stretch to say that DPRK was not so happy with WFP, and that's the reason. I mean, the reason is that there are more countries, ROK being the major one, giving more food into the country without strings. And so why do you have to worry about, if you're DPRK, any entity going around looking at where the food is going if other countries give you the food and don't care where the food is going? So that is, in fact, what's happening. And I don't also think it's true that ROK is giving any money multilaterally or any food multilaterally through WFP at all. But the point is, what we anticipated might happen did. This isn't, I mean, it's bad from the perspective of there aren't going to be monitors of any great levels in the country in order to see what happens to the food. But the ultimate purpose, which gets back to some of the premises in Hazel's book and some of the questions that our chairman asked, or president asked us at the very beginning, is this good? And over the long term, the answer is yes, it's good. There are more countries with more relations and more discussions with North Korea, in large part, Hazel says, I think, and I certainly say, because of the work of the humanitarians, imperfect work, accidental, as Hazel says. We didn't go there for that purpose. We went there to save lives. And Marcus tells us how imperfect some of it is sometimes. But it worked. It worked to save lives, and it worked to help open up the rest of the world. And as a result of that, now it's getting smaller and smaller and having less to do. I mean, and the WFP plan is, by the way, about 10 people in order to do this new project that I mentioned. But since we're almost done and while I have the floor, I want to circle back to what President Sondland said at the beginning and just make a couple of other points. But one is about China, it was made by, mentioned by a couple of people, the issue of a DPRK going to China as a possible model. At least in my time, the government really resented anybody saying, why don't you do things like China? Because I guess they kept hearing it from a lot of different people. And at one point, actually, the government told me that they were going to go with the China model. It's the China-Hong Kong model. And in the Korean context, North Korea is China and South Korea is Hong Kong.
I think that both the speakers raised some very interesting issues, indirectly. I think that the scholarship that's coming out of the Russian Academy, and I can't read Russian, but the ones I've seen in English, that has really illuminating about North Korea. There are many Russian scholars and diplomats who've spent a long time in Korea, who speak Korean, and who've been able to analyse their experiences, and it's just very, very fruitful. In terms of the comments that Mark said, which are, as always, are incisive and clearly put, I would just say that we have in North Korea now a different framework than we had 10 years ago. The socio-economy has been reconstituted as a market economy, and it's, in my view, irreversible. That means in that economy, there are winners and losers. We no longer have the concerns by the North Korean government of the previous decade, where there was meant to be some sort of distribution of food, not on an egalitarian basis, but on a transparent basis. So industrial workers got more. If you were a child, you got less. It was all at the public distribution centres. It was all written up. How many work points do you get? And everybody knew how much food you got. That's gone. That situation is gone. You get food now based, as you say, on your relationship to the market, how much your one is going to buy. It's better if you've got foreign currency. If you've got relations in the country that can send you some food, that's another way still of doing it, still of bartering and swapping, still got some primitive market transactions taking place, but increasingly on a very familiar market economy basis. In my view, and I think it is too early to tell, the government's pronouncements about taking back the public distribution system and putting rice through there are a political move, as I said earlier. It can't be done economically. Farmers are still under-declaring yields. There's so much economic activity going on that it's nothing to do with the state throughout the country. This, by now, a decade and a half later, is just a matter of fact. The other thing about the government's sway, the government doesn't have sway, actually, in terms of implementation capacity over most of the country outside Pyongyang, and that's because, why is that? Because of what I pointed out earlier, that it's local party officials and local security officials that have actually took the lead and have benefited from commercially through their contacts. These are the ones that were able to be the new entrepreneurs outside Pyongyang, being able to make money off the new market opportunities. Now we have in North Korea a poor country, much more like some countries in Southeast Asia than Northeast Asia, with nutritional indicators similar to Laos, parts of India and Indonesia. We have the South Korea really is where the action is. And for those of us that don't understand that, we've got to really try to get to grips with this. And South Korea's aid policy, which I haven't agreed with, and I've talked to a number of my colleagues and friends in South Korea, is that they're going to work more closely with North Korea. There's going to be more bilateral aid. If North Korea looks like it's going to face the sorts of trouble that it's faced in the mid-1990s, they are not going to stand by and they're not going to allow another famine. But at the same time, South Korean bilateral aid is not going in to get to the poorest. South Korean bilateral aid is going in to support monetization of rice, monetization of aid, as aid policy works in lots of different countries, such as to encourage the market. That's what South Korean aid policy is for. And the idea is that it's not that South Korean foreign policy doesn't think that poor shouldn't get aid, that's not true, but they think it's up to the North Koreans to decide who's going to get what with the aid they've got in, using their priorities. Now, that might be unpalatable for a DC-based audience, but that's what South Korean aid is about. It's about putting in aid so that the government uses it and decides what it wants to do with it. That's what it's about. And it hopes also that by doing this, it will encourage further use of rice as a currency. Because rice was not the majority food, at least in the north of the country prior to all the international aid going in. It was millet and it was potatoes in the north. rice is a high-value commodity in the country that can be used to exchange. So, for instance, some of the diversion issues were about rice being given to beneficiaries and them using it to swap. So they could get the same amount of calories in millet and then they could use the rest for other things. So rice is a currency. And so I think that we're talking about different projects here. And we're talking about the South Koreans being very concerned also at the moment. I think the harvest is a red herring. I mean, they're producing about 4.5 million tons, and basic survival levels, they need 5 million tons to cover basic needs. At basic consumption levels, the South Korean agronomist who's responsible for South Korean food aid, I was talking to him a few weeks ago, they need 7 million tons for reasonable consumption levels, and that's going to come through South Korean support. So the South Koreans simply have got a different idea about what food aid should do. If we're talking to them. That's it.
Time has almost come out, but we have one further question here. If you can make it brief, please.
Try to make it brief. I'm Masood Haider from WFP. From 2002 to 2004, I was the humanitarian coordinator for the UN in North Korea. It occurs to me, I've of course not read Hazel's book, although she's flashed it in front of me several times at several stages. What occurred to me is that we are talking about humanitarian assistance as having been an important instrument of policy for the last 10 years. And I think North Korea provides a very good example of what are the strengths and weaknesses of this particular instrument in particular circumstances. So, a few questions on this theme, if I may. First, was it a good instrument for engagement over and above saving lives, which is why the humanitarian agencies went in? But was it a successful instrument for engaging the North Koreans? If so, how come after 11 years of engagement, we are so summarily dismissed from North Korea? Something to work out. Second, certainly in North Korea, humanitarian assistance overwhelmingly meant food. Food and food. What about water and sanitation? Because you cannot really make food assistance effective if it's not supported with water and sanitation. And in North Korea, I would put it to you, it has never been supported with water and sanitation programs. Same about health, very low levels of health inputs. And appallingly low levels of inputs on heating. This is a very cold country, and humanitarian assistance basket never included a component for heating. So was the humanitarian assistance basket well balanced is the second question. Third question, was humanitarian assistance sufficiently insulated from political concerns of the donors? Briefly, no. What are the lessons here? Perhaps there were too few major donors. This is something that the humanitarian organizations, humanitarian agencies have got to keep in mind if they possibly can. Fourth, the monitoring obsession. Yeah. Monitoring is right, monitoring is crucial. But it cannot be perfect. Not perfect in Sudan, not perfect in North Korea, not perfect in Indonesia, not perfect ever under these circumstances. How do you make a balance of that? Because certainly there was a concern that went beyond all reasonable limits in North Korea. What lesson about using humanitarian assistance and humanitarian presence as an instrument for promoting human rights? I don't know the answer to that. It's certainly a question worth posing. How to get away from a widespread impression in most recipient countries that if you have humanitarian assistance, it somehow prevents you from having development assistance. So there's a scramble to stop humanitarian assistance in order to reach out for development assistance. Something wrong here, and whose failure is it? How can we correct this? And finally, what can we say after 11 years about the issue of transition, after 11 years of assistance, is North Korea better prepared to transit from emergency into development? If there's a hunger in North Korea, there's also a hunger, certainly, for development. And a hunger among the bureaucrats, certainly, for better training on those basic ideas, collection of ideas and knowledge that would promote their ability to deal with development. We all know at one point or the other, development will start. There'll be a huge scramble the way things are for assisting North Korea, but no one is prepared in North Korea for dealing with development. So it's an interesting set of questions that arise. Since I've not read your book, I don't know if you deal with any of those, but they certainly occurred to me. Thank you.
Well, a long list of interesting questions. I want to give our primary presenter and author of our last word here, and with regrets that we don't have more time, please, if you have any final comments or maybe your colleagues.
I'll be very brief because I know that it's late. I think from my study that humanitarian organizations are simply there to do a humanitarian job, and it's a limited task, and they do what they can in the circumstances that are given to them. And it's foolish if they have, of course, humanitarian officials have to be aware of the political context in which they do their job, but they're not political organizations. I mean, I have changed my view on this over a period of time, but I think that that's why they can do their job better when they're aware of the political context internationally and nationally, but they're aware that they have a limited task. And it's specific to the time and the place. In North Korean time and place, it was food. And of course, there are all the related issues, but then I think, myself, water, sanitation, all the rest of it, gets into development issues, the massive capital expenditure that would be required, really, to do something systematically, given that North Korea is an urban area. When UNICEF, for instance, started to engage in water, it found that it was using, for two water rigs, something like 60% of its budget in a particular year. So there are questions. Of course, all those issues are important. But where I think the broader issues on how does one support activities that can help transform a society in transition to more freedom, to more prosperity, then, and if there are interlocutors, and that's the job of government interlocutors to do that, then they need to have a strategic approach which looks at what they want to achieve: more human rights, more freedom, more prosperity, more secure regional environment, in the context of knowledge, of a knowledge base which is as free as possible from presumed ideas about how the society works.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Hazel, and our two other presenters. Very interesting.